Howdy, folks, and welcome back to another episode of Meta-Ideological Politics. Today, we are here with Greg Dember. Greg is a writer, musician, and computer programmer living in Seattle. He received his BA in psychology from Yale University, where he also studied literature. His recent intellectual preoccupations include questions about identity and consciousness, and how people project narrative and selfhood onto other humans, animals, and objects. Musically, Greg records and performs as a post-genre singer-songwriter and sometimes plays in other people's bands. The computer programmer part is how he earns his keep. See Greg's online business card at gregdember.com. And also I'll add that, Greg, it's been a pleasure to, you know, get to know you and talk to you and kind of enfold you into this little meta-ideological community that we've been cultivating. So it's great to have a formal interview with you here. So welcome.
Yeah. Hi.
Awesome. So to kind of frame this discussion, as you and I were talking about setting up this episode, we were talking about exploring some of the similarities, perhaps some of the differences between metamodernism, especially metamodernism as you understand it, and our ever-evolving definition and understanding of meta-ideological politics. We do not identify as metamodern, right? But we could say that certain aspects of metamodern philosophy and theories probably inform our thinking on meta-ideology and related subjects. So just to, you know, open it up here, explain to us, Greg, what is metamodernism?
Okay. Actually, I hope this is okay, but I want to also kind of like add to your bio of me. So all the stuff in the bio is kind of the, like, everything else about me besides metamodernism. And then I think, you know, like, kind of like why I'm here representing metamodernism or whatever is, I co-edit a website called whatismetamodern.com with my thinking partner, Linda Cariello. I've spoken at conferences about metamodernism and, you know, and done, I'm not an academic, but I've done some publishing, co-writing with Linda in academic publications and things like that. So I'm not just a random singer-songwriter here to talk about metamodernism. Yeah, so I'm going to give kind of like my version of what metamodernism is. And I'm aware that I think probably a lot of your viewers maybe are familiar with a different sense of what metamodernism means. So we can kind of tease that apart as well. You know, in simplest terms, metamodernism is the name that's getting adopted by many people to identify the period in cultural history that comes after postmodernism. And the kind of general chronological sense around that is that postmodernism began sometime around the middle of the 20th century, you know, sometime after World War II, and then maybe a little bit before 2000, kind of had sort of played itself out to some degree, and kind of a new sensibility emerged. And that got named popularly metamodernism in 2010 with this essay by co-authors Timotheus Vermeulen and Robin van Denneker. And, you know, again, they were cultural theorists who, you know, as they explain it, in when they were, you know, students and graduate students and such, all of the theory that was being thrown at them used the notions of postmodernism and sort of assumed that that was the prevalent sort of state of the art way of thinking about culture. But as they were looking around at the art and painting and music and film and everything that was actually contemporaneous, it didn't seem to fit into the theoretical models of postmodernism. And, you know, also around the same, like for myself, I started noticing that too before I'd ever come across their you know, their theorization of it. And I'm an older Gen X guy. So I came of age in the 80s and the 90s. when the postmodern aesthetic sensibility was like really at its peak. And I liked a lot about that. And so my idea of what postmodernism is it's culture that's preoccupied with context, and with questioning universalized assumptions. And so a lot of postmodern film, music, etc., art is about bringing attention to the art form itself, bringing attention to previously marginalized voices, blurring boundaries that had been thought of as, you know, unquestionably distinct, things like that. And it did, and also kind of like challenging the modernist sort of assumption that there's depth everywhere. So the modernism, which comes before postmodernism, was about scraping away the kind of like accumulated cultural bullshit that had arisen over the thousands of years of tradition, and sort of scraping all that away and finding something that was more true and real and objective underneath. And then postmodernism was, you know, like, okay, that's cool that you've liberated us from the accumulation of tradition, but are you so sure that this structure that you think you see underneath the stuff you've scraped away, how sure are you that that's as solid as you're saying it is? Maybe if we scrape at that, we'll find there's a layer under that, and then a layer under that, and then a layer under that. So postmodernism kind of has that insight. And then a lot of the artistic and cultural expressions of postmodernism therefore move to a very playful kind of funhouse sense, where it's just a lot about finding interconnections between things and how things refer to other things and how things refer to themselves and stuff like that. So what does this have to do with metamodernism? The preoccupation of metamodernism is a response to the way that postmodernism kind of like drain often as a side effect drains away any sense of interiority or self or meaningfulness in things. It's so afraid of being caught taking anything too seriously that you just sort of end up with a society of people that are just kind of always like winking and nodding and making ironic references and proving that they catch the ironic references and stuff. And so the way I see it is that around 2000, a lot of artists and creators, as well as their audiences, became exhausted with that. And so they started trying to bring a sense of meaningfulness and personal interiority and truth and beauty and all that back into their work. But they couldn't and didn't do it in a way that was oblivious to all of the insights of postmodernism. So they end up creating these works that pay their respects to the ironic playfulness of postmodernism while also embedding themselves with a more sincere sense of meaningfulness. And the Vermeulen and Van Denneker, the ones who gave it the term metamodernism, kind of made famous in their formulation. They talked about metamodern works involving an oscillation between modernist sensibilities such as truth and enthusiasm and excitement about new inventions and things like that, and postmodern sensibilities of irony and detachment and surface play and things like that. I'll try to bring this in for landing. And so what we do on the whatismetamodern.com site and in other writings is just kind of catalog all these examples in the arts of things that are not a modern.
David Foster Wallace is often held up as one of the first sort of metamodern fiction writers. And he was writing in the 90s and the 2000s. And there was, I remember an interview with him once where somebody asked him what is postmodernism? And he said, oh, I don't know. It's whatever is after modernism. And he asked him to characterize it. And he was thinking back on why he liked a bunch of postmodern writers when he was learning how to write in school. And he said, I thought they were so clever. I thought they were so, they had such an enlightened, cynical attitude that I thought was so cool when I was 22 years old. And then when he grows up, he figures out that the reason he really liked them in the first place is that they were able to be so in your face, formal, and yet still hit you with emotion underneath. You could be reading a Pynchon novel or a Donald Barthelme short story, and there's all this playful things happening and all this formalism, and yet you're still affected. And that, I mean, it sounds to me like that's metamodernism.
Yeah.
You're characterizing it. So the question is, if that was what was cool about postmodernism in the first place, then what makes metamodernism different? Is it the self-awareness?
Well, I guess I haven't seen him saying that exactly. But I guess I disagree with David Foster Wallace, if you're allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so my take on David Foster Wallace was always that his nonfiction writing, like his essay and opinion, sort of was a herald of metamodernism. Like he criticized the detachment in postmodernism and called for a new sincerity. And he has that like famous quote that everybody, I can't cite it off the top of my head, but where he says like, the new heroes, the new cool will be the people who are sincere, who are willing to risk being sincere. So I think in his commentary, he's kind of like an early metamodern harbinger, but in his own work, in his fiction, that seems pretty, it seems quite postmodern, right, to me. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that.
I guess like the way I'll reconcile the way he described those postmodern authors with my sense they still weren't metamodern, they were postmodern, is I think that those authors and David Foster Wallace himself were very much on the side of the playful irony, blah, 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 blah. And in the standards of the time, sure, you know, there was some emotion in there, or nobody, if there was no emotion in there at all, right, people just wouldn't read it. But it was hidden and obscured and winked at and sort of embarrassed about itself in ways that actual, you know, metamodern stuff kind of is freed from. Is that satisfactory?
I think that's an answer. That's an answer to think about. Although maybe it's that I'm reading it from the lens of 2021 that I look back on a lot of these postmodern things, and to my mind, it looks like, oh, they're centering the emotion, but there's no way to get through this really earnest, you know, this earnestness is associated with a modernist impulse. Mm-hmm. They're centering it, but there's no way to get that through to the postmodern audience in the late 20th century without doing it through the lens of playfulness, irony, cynicism. So,
and that
I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to get the right words for this, because I think what you're saying is true, and I could also see how the way you've described it sounds a lot like the way I described metamodernism. So then the question is, what is the difference? And I'm sure there, like, I stand by that there is a big difference, because when I look at the stuff that's been, you know, coming up over the last 20 years, it feels really different from the stuff in the 70s and 80s,
yeah.
90s.
That, Kanye West is different from Kurt Cobain, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is somehow very different from Tarantino or these people in the 90s. But I struggle to put my finger on what it is. Is it just a matter of degree, in terms of how much this earnestness is allowed to break through? It just right at the point that they're equal to each other. That's the metamodern, that you can't decide which way it's going.
And I think a lot, like the really, like, most metamodern stuff is where the oscillation is not just found in the work itself. The oscillation is in the audience's reaction to it. So the way you just put that, so as the audience, you're like, wait, are they just joking around? Or no, are they being incredibly earnest? Or no, are they making fun of someone who would be incredibly earnest? Or no, you know, and as like it very much creates that kind of a thing, and then you just kind of take it all, you, as the audience person, eventually you just have to kind of like stop trying to figure out which it is.
What it is, right? It is what it is.
Whereas I think with the postmodern stuff, like you could easily say and argue and share with your friends, you could say like, no, this is all just a joke. And then sort of in this very quiet, implicit way, there might've been some authentic, meaning and emotion, but, it could argue for itself. The postmodern stuff could kind of proclaim itself to be ironic.
Right.
Does that work?
I think that works.
Okay.
That's satisfactory to me. I'm thinking, I think comedy is sort of, I think usually the avant-garde of culture. And I'm thinking of like Andy Kaufman, you would say is postmodern. He's doing a character, he's doing a bit, but you know it's a bit, and you know that he knows it's a bit.
Right.
Whereas someone like Joe Pera, who I was watching the other right. day, on Adult Swim, and Adult Swim, I think, has a lot of metamodern content. Mm-hmm. I truly have no idea if that's what he's like, or if that's yes. it. I really do not know.
That's a really good example, because with Joe Pera, and I've only seen a little bit of him, but with, you can sort of sit there and be like, oh, this is so sweet and wholesome. But then, like, it could all be a bit. It could be that he's sitting there scoffing at people who think it's serious, or, and I feel like this kind of works with, I'm having a mind blank, but what's the very popular TV show on Apple Plus about the soccer coach?
And Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso. Yeah. So Ted Lasso, I think, is, especially in the first season, is similar to Joe Pera, where like, even if the point of it is primarily to be kind of wholesome, it's in this context where people are very aware of the strong possibility of things not being wholesome. Like, it's not just like the Waltons or something. It's not just like Little House on the Prairie. It's like in your face, wholesome and sincere. Like it knows that it's doing something unusual by being that way. Whereas Andy Kaufman, if you're in the audience and you start sort of just sinking into a simple, like, you know, like when Andy Kaufman is doing his Elvis rendition, and you're, if you're in the audience and you're just sitting there going like, I love Elvis, I love this song, he's gonna pull the rug out from under you and you're the jerk for not getting it, right? Whereas with the metamodern thing, you're never the audience is never the jerk.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question, Greg. I don't know if this is kind of a pedantic, you know, linguistic nitpicking here, but is there a meaningful difference between the words meta, as in like metamodernism? Mm-hmm. And I ask this because we're meta ideological politics, yeah. right? And like postmodernism, other than the yeah. fact that meta is used to just, metamodernism is used to distinguish itself from postmodernism, but is there a substantive difference there? Because we thought when we were coming up with the name for the show, we initially thought about post-ideological politics, mm-hmm. But then we decided to go with meta for various reasons. So I was wondering if you had thoughts on that.
Yeah, I guess I understand that in actual Greek, like in contemporary Greek, not ancient Greek, but like the Greek spoken by people who live in Greece now, meta is just their word for after. So meta and post are completely synonymous in that context. But I think in the way meta and post are kind of used as prefixes in, you know, sort of intellectualized language in English, they are different from each other. And post, you know, post very much means after. When it's used in something like postmodernism or, you know, post-progressive or whatever, it means after, but it does have a sense of after, but still in relation to the thing that's before. So postmodernism isn't only after modernism, it's after modernism, but it's in response to modernism and it's informed by modernism and all of those things. It's not a simple departure from. Whereas the way meta is generally used in sort of intellectualized language, it more means above, I think. So it's not simply linearly after, it's after and above and outside of and looking back upon. Vermeulen and van Denneker, when they explain how they decided to call metamodernism meta-modernism, what they emphasize is another connotation of meta from ancient Greek, from ancient Greek, you know, not contemporary Greek. It's related to a word metaxy, which means moving back and forth between. Mm-hmm. And so that's their same kind of sense of oscillation. So they decided to call it metamodernism, really to connote moving back and forth between these modernist and postmodern sensibilities. And like, if I think about your meta ideological politics, as I understand it, I don't think you're really so much into the metaxy sense, but I do think it's different from post. I think it's better. It's a better term for what you think you're doing than post ideology. Cause you're sort of saying like ideology is there, but we're also looking at it from the outside and we're aware of it and we're ideological about our ideology, or we're aware of that dimension. Whereas post-ideology has more of a sense of like, we're just not doing ideology anymore. We know it's there, but we're past it.
That's exactly why we decided to go with meta and not post. We didn't want to get into that debate.
Yeah.
So, and speaking of not getting into that debate, you know, there's the other reason why we wanted to emphasize the meta-ideological part is because we are not identifying or centering Hanzi's Nordic ideology or his definition of what metamodernism is, right?
Yeah.
So I thought maybe now we can get into the distinction between your understanding of metamodernism and Hanziism or Hanzi's Nordic ideology, metamodernism.
Yeah. So my take on it from the reading that I've done and kind of also just from picking up on like the extended adjacent culture, you know, of other people that have been influenced by the Hanzi authors is, I guess, like what it has in common with the metamodernism that I connect to is that it's in some sense proposing something to come after postmodernism. But what they say comes after postmodernism and also what they're doing is more of saying like, here's what we want to see come after postmodernism. And what we're saying with metamodernism is here is what has already emerged and is observable, you know, in the world. But what they want to see coming after postmodernism is not the same as what we're describing. And I think that Hanziism or, you know, Hanziistic post-metamodernism is mostly centered on this developmental stage idea, and that it's sort of a human potential thing. Like humans can be better, humans can have a more sophisticated cognitive state, and that what they're activist about, what they're proposing is they feel that developmentalism should kind of play a part in all levels of society, including government, that, you know, not just education, but just like, you know, everything should incorporate this push for humans to transcend their earlier state of mind. And I think that they inherit that from Ken Wilber's integralism. And I think that a lot of what I've seen in Hanzi metamodernism to me kind of seems like a repackaging of Ken Wilber's integral. In an early blog post on their Meta Moderna site, like either their first or second post, they define metamodernism as an inclusive model that pulls together all realms of human knowledge and science. It's like an integrated model of all sciences and schools of thought that can kind of like encompass everything and explain everything. And that's also how Integral started out defining itself. So that just doesn't to me really have very much commonality with the aesthetic and the sensibility found in all of these movies and songs and paintings and stuff that we identify as metamodern. Then the another part that I think is, and this is where it's going to get interesting, another thing that I think the Hanzi authors emphasize is multi-perspectivalism, and the idea that one can hold seemingly opposed ideas or positions at the same time. And I think they say something like, the winner in life is he who masters the most perspectives. And I think that people think sometimes that that's what my metamodernism is going for, because we talk about oscillation. But we're not talking about oscillation between any two opposing positions. We're talking about oscillation between modernist and postmodern sensibilities. And multi-perspectivalism itself is a postmodern sensibility. It's a rejection of the modernist idea that there is one truth that you can arrive at through cleverness and rationality and science. Metamodernism, as I use it, and when I say I'm part of a whole community of academics and such that use it this way, is not about positional multi-perspectivalism. And in fact, metamodernism is about finding ways to recapture a sense of like personal faith and conviction in the face of multi-perspectivalism. So now this connects to your meta-ideological politics, is because if meta-ideological politics is simply trying to hold multiple political positions and not being sequestered and stuck to one of them, then I think there's value in that as a mental exercise. But that's not what metamodernism is, according to me. And I think that the metamodern version is, how can I honor the fact, how can I honor that there are people who hold various disparate views while being passionate and convicted about my estimation of what's true? And that position is the one that I relate to. So for me, I don't want to obligate myself to believing in like multiple conflicting positions on a question. What I want to do is see the humanity and see the depth and the interiority and the complexity of the people who vehemently disagree with me, while still very proudly or passionately proclaiming my truth and being willing to adapt my truth, but still kind of trusting my instinct.
I think in a sense, and this is kind of obvious, actually, is the idea is that both modernism and postmodernism were wrong, taken as themselves. Both of them are wrongheaded. So you metamodernism thinks of it as an oscillation between modernism and postmodernism, that they're each correcting each other's shortcomings or flaws. But isn't that also the same as saying that we're going back to pre-modernism in some sense, that we're just going back two steps and saying, okay, where should we have developed from pre-modernism? Not to say that we're going back to pre-modern ideals, but where did we go wrong initially that we dropped this sense of interiority and depth and the realness of the other, and we jumped into the structure so that we can only think about coming together in terms of bopping between different ideologies as opposed to seeing what's connected underneath?
Because I don't see that modernism was like a failure or like was a wrong direction. I think that, you know, kind of going back to Ryan's questions about the prefixes, about post and meta, it's post-modernism, but it's in the shadow of modernism, and it's meta-modernism, but it's in the shadow of post-modernism and modernism. It's built like the main thing, the main important thing going on now still is modernism. Like you could forget post-modernism and meta-modernism and just keep the modernism. And to me, we'd be better off than we were before it and without it. But it has its drawbacks. It has its, you know, side effects or whatever. And postmodernism is a corrective for that, but it's not a rejection of modernism. And postmodernism has its drawbacks, but metamodernism is not doing away with postmodernism. It's a corrective for it.
It's not doing away with postmodernism, but from my thinking, the good parts of postmodernism were already being done before modernism. If postmodernism is a certain skepticism about systems, well, you can point to the ancient Greeks were doing that. Plato was doing that. Plato's Parmenides, I think, was, you know, I would put that in the canon of metamodern works. If metamodernism is just a kind of playful awareness of the possible nebulosity and incompleteness of your theories. And in that work, he criticizes his own theory of the forms, and he kind of destroys it, but then he comes out afterwards still affirming it as something that we need to live by, which is reminiscent of like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where, you know, they see that the relationship is a failure, and at the end, they still affirm it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a this sort of epistemic model, like we call these things epistemes. I mean, not everybody does, but that's the term. So then I say the epistemic model, this sort of tradition, modernism, postmodernism, metamodernism, epistemic model is basically about the 20th and now the 21st century. Right. So yeah, I've had people critique and say like, don't you know about the Chinese in the third century and the, right. You know, the whatever. And it's like, yeah, this whole sort of cycle may have played itself out at different times in history and in different places, and it may not be relevant to some parts of the world right now and stuff like that, but it's just a description of the kind of cultural unconscious of the West, of the American centric, to be honest, you know, Anglo-American centric West from sometime in like the mid 1800s till now, and that's all it's really claiming to be. Although it might describe a pattern where you have, you know, sort of like unself-conscious, unexamined traditions that then get challenged by rational individualists who feel that they can discover something more true by departing from everything that they've been, you know, brought up with. And that would be the modernist part of the cycle. And then the postmodern, looking back on these new modernist conclusions and looking for the fragments and the fault lines and the unexamined assumptions of them. And then the metamodern part of the cycle is saying like, wait, where did we lose our own sense of faith in ourselves and interiority as we've been doing all of this mental examination? And it may well be that that stuff kind of has replayed itself in different contexts.
Yeah, that, I think that's the essence of my contention here, that like that it is, it's just, it's like waves on the shore, it keeps happening over and over again. Tradition mm-hmm. never happens and isn't met with criticism. So is it too heady to say that we're metamodern theorists? Why not just say we're integrated or commonsensical or holistic or something like that? Why keep using the term modern that now that we're 2 degrees removed from it?
I just want to interject and say, like, I love the way this conversation is going. Like, These are the kinds of questions that, you know, I wish I was spending more time talking about, both with like my colleagues in the metamodernism world and with the like sort of outsiders. So this is great.
Well, let me say also, Greg, that I've been reading your work since college, when I, you know, in freshman year of college, when I was a stereotypical freshman reading David Foster Wallace. your works were the first, were the ones that I was reading to try to get a sense of that. So I appreciate this as well.
Okay. So here we are. and you're asking the good questions. In fact, can you just restate the question?
Well, I think that where I came to was, why keep using the term modern if we're recognizing that this is a cyclical process and we don't necessarily need to be wedded to, you know, what started in the 19th or early 20th century in America and the West, but mostly in America.
Well, I hope this doesn't sound glib, but because we are in this time period, like we are in this decade and we are in this recent history, and maybe there's a place for a theorist, you know, to get really abstract and kind of like come up with some more generic terminology that does make it applicable to other eras. But if you're trying to explain, you know, developments in architecture in the 1910s and developments in literature, you know, in the same time, et cetera, it works to call that modernist. And if you're wanting to explain how that shifted, how that sensibility shifted in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and then especially in the 80s and 90s, it's useful to call it postmodern. I don't know, is that satisfactory at all?
Fair enough. And you know, you're such a proponent for, let's treat it as a relatively specific academic term that it is, you know, so I think, yeah, especially if we're talking about architecture or something where those terms are pretty, like modernism is in a pretty discrete architectural form, you know,
right,
as is postmodernism. In that sense, of course, yes, it makes sense to talk about metamodernism.
Go ahead, Ryan.
No, go ahead, Greg.
Well, I wanted to ask either of you, and you know, maybe Ryan, because you haven't spoken as much, like, how do you feel about the distinction I was making between the simple sort of multi-perspectivalism of making all positions equal versus the version that I'm kind of more identified with, where like you have no apologies about your own positions, but yet you recognize the good faith and humanity in people with the other positions?
That's exactly what I was going to ask about. So I've been thinking about this from several different angles, so we can kind of run through each of these, right? So I was at the shower at LA Fitness thinking about this. So let me give you an example. So, you know, as I think both of you know, I get a particular kick out of connecting with the diverse ideological communities, right? So I have a conservative Catholic group that I'm a part of. I'm part of you know, the different kind of like super left activist groups in Portland, right? I'm part of different kind of business communities. And I enjoy interacting with people on their own terms through their own concepts and world space, right? And in that interaction, let's say with the conservative Christian communities I'm a part of, there is a kind of sincerity that comes through in that a part of me really does resonate with those ideas, but not 100%. That's I could say that's like maybe 10% of who I am, or my full spectrum of emotional and aesthetic and philosophical resonances, right? But that's not all of who I am. And the people in the group don't necessarily know that as soon as the meeting is over, I'm going to go join the Black Lives Matter rally, right? Like, they don't know that about me, but that's what will happen, right? And so there is a sincerity found in a partial expression of a perspective as a part of who I am, or as part of my multidimensional political psyche, shall we call it. So that's the first part, is like, what do you think about that in terms of meeting people where they are in a way that feels sincere and coherent and congruent with me and my ideals, but that just not being the whole story of who I am. Is that kind of like a postmodern thing or a modern thing or a meta? Like, how do you think about that?
Okay. So it sounds like, Ryan, the way you're describing yourself is that your participation in these groups, like the conservative Catholics, for example, it sounds like it satisfies you in two different levels. Like on one level, it's part of your post-ideological project. And it's kind of part of like a bridge building project of saying like people from different perspectives need to start talking to each other and, you know, taking each other seriously and not just ignoring and fighting. And then, but yet on that level, you know, you're in there as Ryan, who's generally left-wing and progressive and not, I assume you're not Catholic, et cetera. And you're doing this thing, you're kind of playing this game, this important game with them. But it sounded like you also said on another level, there even is some part of the complete Ryan that resonates with those people that does not get satisfaction anywhere else. Is that
beautiful? Possible? Beautiful paraphrase, Greg.
Okay. And that's really similar to my own experience doing those kinds of things. Like a sort of formative experience for me was about 10 years ago, just through like a weird series of accidents, I ended up spending a lot of time with a group of young evangelical Christians. And it sort of started out as kind of like a, you know, like a bridge building project, a multi-perspectival kind of project of like, shouldn't we at least try to, you know, talk to these people? But it ended up being that, and also finding like some genuine resonances with them, that a part of me completely on a, you know, just on a very authentic non-project level was really like kind of gratified by. Like I found satisfaction with that group of friends in ways that my regular friends did not provide for me. But I never, and we would talk about, you know, our differences, me and these evangelical Christians. And I never once though stopped being pro-abortion, you know, for example. But on the other hand, I came to understand that their anti-abortion stance wasn't like they weren't just being pills, like they weren't just motivated by like trying to like, you know, bully women or like screw the left or whatever. Like they think that embryos are babies. Like they think that that's a baby. They picture a baby in there. And so they're like saying like, aren't you at least concerned that you're killing a baby? You know, and the difference between me and them is like, I don't think that's a baby. Like I objectively, scientifically don't see that as a baby. And I also morally think that a woman has the right to bodily autonomy over and above everything else. But in their worldview, nobody, it's not just a sexist, misogynist thing. It's like they, in their worldview, everybody, male or female or whatever, has obligations that go beyond their own personal autonomy. And I don't see it that way, but I respect that that's where they're coming from. If that makes sense, that they're good people. Like they're like, in fact, like if they're going and marching and protesting abortion centers, and I would be on there on the other side, vehemently opposed to them, but they're doing that. Like, at least they're like taking time away from watching football or something to do something they believe in, you know? So like, I have that level of respect for them. And that I also, when that's all over, I can hang out with them and laugh about things that we both think are funny, or, you know, we can all listen to Sufjan Stevens
music and enjoy it for our different reasons or things like that. Or if they're having a problem in their relationship, like I care and I want to hear the update and how's that going and give my perspective if it helps. And if I have similar problems, I can find solace in their sympathy for me, because we're all people.
You know, it reminds me of a story that I had where during like prayers, right, at these different groups, like I'm not religious, right? So I don't literally believe in like a heaven or an afterlife or that kind of thing. And they would do these prayers and recite different scriptures that would talk about, like, you know, heaven or God in a certain way that I don't think of naturally or intuitively. And what I was feeling from them in that moment was like, they really do believe in like the power of like literally believing in something. I could feel like the images and the kind of emotive, you know, the aesthetics and that whole kind of Christian tradition kind of, I was just kind of imbibing it by osmosis with this kind of empty sincerity, knowing that I can never believe that they could, like, I will never believe this, but I can feel it from a distance. And it's kind of like, I can't remember who said, I think it was like a Japanese poet of like, even though I'm in Kyoto, I still long for Kyoto. It was kind of that moment there. And that's kind of part of the enjoyment that too. It's like, I'm not going to believe that like you guys are, but right. I can appreciate that sincerely, knowing that I can't ever.
Yeah. Right, like there's a beauty. There's like a profound beauty.
Yes.
Yeah.
In that difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I lived in Java, I only lived there for like 10 weeks or so, but they did the call to prayer 5 times a day. And I just retweeted someone else who was saying this. Like, he said, I'm not Muslim. I don't understand Islam. I will never be Muslim, but still the call to prayer. There's a kind of beauty in the call to prayer that you just don't, you can't exactly translate it to any other religion, because it's a specific kind of thing. And it holds you. It brings you in 5 times a day and says, be here, be present. And you know that everyone else in your neighborhood is also praying. And there's just a beauty in that you can't get in Catholicism or Buddhism or anything else. And, you know, there is a sense of just admiring it from afar and appreciating it from afar. But I also worry, like, is it arrogant to do that? You're like, isn't that nice? You know, pat on the head. Like, it's great that you guys love that. But here I am, the enlightened meta being who believes in nothing really, but bounces, you know, that always comes to mind. Like, oh, well, gee, would it be more respectful actually to double down on my disagreement as opposed to, you know, saying, oh, I lightly agree. I can see where you're coming from.
I think that,
I worry about.
Yeah, I think that there's both a kind of authentic respect evidenced in being honest about your differences and disagreements and not just patronizing the other views. And then there's also a kind of authentic respect in, I think, the way Ryan was describing his experience with the Catholic rituals, where, like, you're not just looking at it from outside and patting them on the head. Like, you get swept up a little bit. And then you maybe have the voice in the back of your head going like, wait, they actually really believe in heaven and hell. And I do not believe that. But until that voice speaks up on a more primal level, you can, you know, like, or with the call to prayer, like, without getting into the abstractions, you can, on just this primal level, genuinely, to some degree, you know, appreciate and get wrapped up in it. Like, I had an experience like that with this group of people where someone in their community had died, an older man who, you know, didn't have a lot of family and friends of his own, and he'd been sort of like adopted by these younger evangelical Christians, and he died, and they had a service for him, and they knew that I played piano, so they actually like asked me to play piano for these hymns that they were gonna sing. And it was funny because I don't really read music very much. I more play, you know, by ear, but I can kind of read music, especially if there's chords on there and stuff like that. So I was just like, okay. And then it was like this total like jump into the abyss of the unknown, because it's like, I don't even know if I'm gonna play it right. and I just did it anyway, and I'm suddenly like being transported by this sea of voices singing in this like really natural, unpretentious harmony, these songs that like probably have meaning for them, resonating with many prior experiences about this man that they cared about. And, you know, the words, maybe I don't fully agree with the like theological premise, but they are poetic. And like, and I'm the guy playing piano in all of this. And so like, if I just didn't think about it on the abstract level, like there, I was like right there in there getting to be it. And so it wasn't like this anthropologist looking at it from the outside.
I want to respond to that question too, Nate, because I think the worst accusation I've got from all of these memetic anthropological adventures is kind of like I'm being two-faced, right? Like if I'm not being upfront that I'm only in 10% agreement or resonance, right? This is only a sliver of who I am being represented in this community. Like that's kind of inauthentic. And so this is the response I came up with when I was talking to my wife about this in the car. What happens, what if the very act of this kind of multi-perspectival, multi-community, you know, going around to different places, interacting people, what happens if that is in and of itself an authentic expression of who I am, right? What happens if that connection, that the kind of paradox here, I guess, between the postmodern and the modern or the metamodern, right, is that the sincerity, the earnestness of who Ryan is and what I really believe as a meta-ideological ideologue is expressed in doing that. Like, what do you think of that, Greg? Like,
yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have anything like really interesting to say, because I think you just kind of nailed it. I mean, I think that's the same for me, like in my forays into various little subcultures and stuff, because the evangelical Christianism is the only one that I've forayed into. And like, for me, besides any sort of like social value that I see and like we have to learn to talk to each other or whatever, I am just genuinely selfishly curious and fascinated by different subcultures. Like just on this purely selfish, like in the same way I enjoy reading a good novel or seeing a movie or watching a documentary, it's like, I want to go there. I want to go and see what it's like. And that's genuine. That's not patronizing. It doesn't have a purpose, you know, like a higher purpose or anything. And so I think like owning that kind of helps you keep it real. And if that is coming through, like I bet that comes through unconsciously to the people that you're interacting with, and they like it.
I mean, I haven't gotten kicked out of anywhere yet, so hopefully it's working. But I think to kind of put a bow on this, the phrase that came to my mind if someone accuses me of being two-faced is, I'm not being two-faced, I'm 1,000-faced, and that is an authentic expression of who Ryan is.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's an authentic expression of who you are, Ryan. I think you are uniquely like this from everything I've seen of you. But then like my question is, for people who are not naturally 1,000-faced, which is many people, like how do they tap into that without then being inauthentic to their own predisposition to be convicted to believe in this, and I don't want to veer from this, I don't want to, whereas you want to.
I think like what I was saying about the Catholic prayer events though, right, some of the sincerity and the authentic relating comes in the difference. Right. It's the absent. It's like, I'm not going to believe what they're going to believe, and I can't force myself to. If someone put a gun to my head and said, believe in heaven, literally, I wouldn't be able to do it, and I would be shot. But I can the swept up, as you're talking about, right, Greg, like being swept up kind of in these things, it's not only swept up in the kind of communion with the object of what they're swept up into, right? But it's also being swept up into the void space, the liminal space between the difference of our perspectives and the kind of longing, the kind of like wabi-sabi, you know, like we're wabi-sabi, there's kind of sadness and beauty in knowing I'll never be able to fully agree with them or like be one with their worldview. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, that's good.
I have a question for you, Ryan, is have you encountered anybody in these groups that you visit
who maybe has the same kind of motivation or fascination that you have coming from the other direction, like even if they couldn't name it and theorize about it, but sort of just on a like gut level. Do you feel that?
Can you say more about like what that would look like? What are you referring to?
Well, exactly? Like somebody who, if they were aware that like you're not the regular conservative Catholic, there's something different about Ryan, you know, from the rest of us, and learning that would make them more interested in you and want to know and sort of like excited that you were in their presence and things like that.
Very interesting. Yeah. I think some of my closest friends I've made in these circles, they do know that about me. And sometimes in those more private conversations with them, right, I'll explicitly share like, you know, kind of part of the backstory of like, this is my philosophy and this is a part of who I am. And I think the other important part too, which I really try to make explicit in the meta-ideological philosophy, is the fact that there's space for me to grow into that more. Like even if my, at the first church gathering, right, I'm kind of like, not really sure about this, but my understanding of their worldview, my understanding of their perspective, my understanding of, you know, the theological, you know, belief systems that they hold, that can grow and flourish, and I can further cultivate that. You know, it's kind of like the Japanese, it's like Kaizen, it's like continual improvement or continual cultivation of that perspective and continual cultivation of the part of me that can resonate with that perspective. That makes sense. And I think they know that. And so it's like, hey, even though I'm not going to believe this 100% in the same way that you do, just the sincerity for me to show up and try matters a lot to them, especially with all the polarization stuff. Yeah. You're getting at? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Cause you know, like sometimes like on Facebook, like I don't really, in my own friends on Facebook are sadly or happily, you know, like 99% in my same ideological silo as me. But a lot of them have friends that have like, you know, right wing views and things like that. And so I'll get into the debates, you know, with these people I don't know, right? And often, or even like I do have a few people in my that are actual people I know that are from the other side of the divide. And often like I'll find that like conservative people will make these efforts to show that they care about you as a human, and like, you know, they'll like try to make some kind of jokes to show common ground and ask you questions about your family or whatever, or you know, or they'll assert like, you know, like I don't know why all this stuff has to be a big fight all the time or whatever. And I usually have two reactions to that. Like the one reaction is like, you're just saying that because you're trying to deflect from, you know, the evilness and the irresponsibility of your point of view. But then when I get through that, I'm just like, no, they're just like me. And, you know, they really do. They don't want to be having to have these arguments and these divisions. They do want everybody to get along. Like some of them maybe don't, maybe some of them thrive on disagreement or whatever, but like most of them, they like people.
So I had another question, Greg, about the multi-perspectivalism and its association with postmodernism. Mm-hmm. And one question I've always had is per that connection, right? What are the taxonomies of perspectives that one is playing with that would make it, that might distinguish it from being in similar spirit to popular associations or manifestations of postmodernism? So as a concrete example, I think a lot of it, like in terms of cultural political manifestations of postmodernism, the taxonomy of perspectives, at least in my experience, tends to be like different kinds of like identity groups based on sociologically mediated patterns of lived experience.
Okay.
But not necessarily integrating or appreciating ideologies or perspectives or worldviews that were more like, let's say, traditionally conservative, along with, you know, more like traditional social justice stuff. Right. And so that's what I would say would be different in terms of, MIP and postmodernism, as you described, would be that the, stylistically, I would say that the multi-perspectivalism is a big part of it, more for the pragmatic value of getting beyond polarization, so from my work in mediation. But also the difference is that in terms of the content of the perspectives we're playing with, it's much broader than what most, how most expressions of postmodernism I've seen have defined multi-perspectivalism.
Okay, yeah, that's a really important question. I mean, I honored the fact that language is as it's used, you know, like I can't tell everybody what the words are supposed to mean, but I think that the association between postmodernism and various identitarian groups that are kind of on the left, I think that that's a recent connotation to postmodernism. You know, so the original postmodern critique, you know, it was like, there's not just one universal truth. There's perspectives that are getting left out. And it was not, in concept, abstractly, it was not privileging, you know, racial minorities and sexual minorities and things like that. It was just saying, like, there can't be one and only one truth. And anytime that you think you've found that one and only truth, you'd be advised to kind of look behind you and look to the side and look underneath and look in the corners and the shadows and see if there's stuff that's missing. And so starting with that critique, since, you know, the patriarchal, straight, white, male, capitalist system or whatever is the predominating system in the West, the outsider perspectives that were getting unearthed by the postmodern multi-perspectival project tended to be racial minority, sexual minority, you know, women and things like that. But on a conceptual level, that's in the service of this more kind of abstract multi-perspectivalism. And now, and so then in the academy, though, like a postmodern approach to, say, studying literature is to say, like, hey, there's not only one way of reading literature, like whatever it is, even Shakespeare, like we have been through now reading it through this white male lens, but we're going to have a feminist critical theory of literature. We're going to have you know, African diaspora version. We're going to have a queer studies version. And the postmodern view from the big picture is just saying, like, we need all these different views. And that could also include, like, we need a Rust Belt, Bible Belt, you know, blue collar way to read literature too. And now in like 2000, in our decade that we're in now, in the last decade, people who, like Jordan Peterson, for example, who are concerned about identitarianism have, in this kind of dumbed down way, used the term postmodernism as a blanket to talk about left-wing identitarianism. But that's not how postmodernism was always used in the past. Like, postmodern architecture didn't really have a politics behind it. You know, and even now, like there's a thing on that you'll see on the web called there's like a group called the Postmodern Jukebox, and they make videos and they take like classic songs and rework them in weird, wacky ways. And there's nothing identitarian, there's nothing social justice warrior, there's nothing woke about that at all. They're using the word postmodern in the original sense that it had, where it's like playfully juxtaposing things in order to shake up our premises. So I don't know, maybe I'm getting too word nerd here, but like I think that that question is all based on this sort of unfortunate way that the public sense of what postmodern means has been dumbed down in the last 10 years. but it doesn't mean it's a dumb question. So what's really, I guess, at the heart, like, of it?
I was thinking about what kind of label would fit my worldview. And I think the word that came to me was, I'm a universal postmodernist.
Okay.
Like, which is kind of like, I guess, you know, I mean, it is kind of an oxymoron or contradiction.
An inclusive postmodernist, kind of.
Right, where I just expand the taxonomy of perspectives, maybe in its more original form.
Yeah, and I would say that's original. And the other thing is that I just want to point out is that, like, Black Lives Matter doesn't, like, they don't run around saying we're postmodernists. Like, the term postmodernism is applied to these groups by people who oppose them. It's not, right? It's like not.
Right. They don't self-identify with that label.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, you know, going back to some, if we make a distinction between like original postmodernism and the abstract of mm-hmm. multi-perspectivalism to shake up fixation on mononarrative, to, you know, modern associations that may have been bastardized or misappropriated, right? Like, who were some of, like, theorists who were talking about it in the way that we're talking about it here? Because when I think about all of the classic names associated with postmodernism, right? Foucault and Derrida and mm-hmm. Deleuze and Baudrillard and Lyotard and all those guys, like, they had a kind of a specific angle. At least that's what's kind of, you know, the popular perception of their work. Mm-hmm. Where I don't, like, Foucault, you know, I mean, his kind of deconstructive historical critique of dominant net norms and narratives and their institutionalization, it doesn't strike me as this kind of universal, like, you know, let's do the Bible Belt working class.
Okay,
you know,
fair enough. So, like, I would, my amateur way of kind of integrating all of this is I still think that all of those people, like, say, like, I know Derrida kind of better than some of the other ones. I think that, like, Derrida's intellectual preoccupation was showing how meaning, the apparent meaning in language, is all relative to the other meanings in language, like that there's no direct tethering of language to any sort of objective reality, and everything and all of our thinking is all based in relative differences between things, and that and then deconstruction being sort of the project of showing how, like, any attempt to assert a truth in language, if you look closely, the language itself undermines what seems to be the apparent truth. And that's not political. That's just conceptual. Now, Derrida was left-leaning politically, and I think he probably ended up using his conceptual project in ways that favored and prioritized left types of projects. And that's probably true for most of them. So maybe they had a blind spot in applying their conceptual postmodernism in a fully universal, inclusive, distributed way. I also suspect that if I knew more about the history of all this, there probably were people doing the kind of thing that you're talking about, but they're not well known. And I mean, there's a little bit, like, you know, there's like Tom Wolfe's interest in, I mean, he's not like a postmodern theorist, but he's a postmodern journalist. And he, you know, he had his interest in the Hell's Angels. I think there's some of what you're asking for was present. But I think you also,
in that same realm. I think I would call Hunter S. Thompson a postmodern right thinker. You know, I wouldn't call him a right winger, but all of his sentiments were pretty right wing.
Right.
I think, and a lot of the people who wrote for National Review back in the 70s, 80s, I would, and before that, I would, you know, they leaned in this direction in the same way that, you know, obviously Derrida fronted the postmodernism, but at one point he said, there's a quote I remember, I don't know where he said it, and maybe he was, you know, not, it's just an offhanded remark, but he said all of his work was an extension of Marxism, you know, So at least in some moods, he thought of it as an extension of left-wing thought, and then maybe in other moods, he thought of it vice mm-hmm. versa, you know, which is, you know, that's how the man thought. Like, it was all, everything yeah. was in parallax. So, yeah. Also, like, culturally speaking, I think most of the people on the right that I've talked to, and the people who live in just right-centric locales, are actually, I've noticed, way more postmodern in their cultural disposition than people on the left. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I worked for a time as a janitor back in Pennsylvania, very rough belt kind of place. And all those people, you go to the break room for the janitors, and they're seeped in irony, they're seeped mm-hmm. in cynicism. It's extremely postmodern. And then I come here to DC and I go to a networking event. These people are very modernist. You know, there's a sheen of cynicism, but they're earnest. These mm-hmm. are earnest people. So yeah, it's
I think Jordan Peterson
did a disservice to associate the postmodernism with the left. It's not obvious to me.
I guess another kind of little sort of thought that, a little nugget of thought that I have too, is I think, like, you know, because of this sort of popularized association between postmodernism and identitarian activist groups, sometimes people think metamodernism would be opposed to the identitarian groups. But I actually think that identitarianism on all sides, left wing, right wing, is an expression of metamodernism. The identitarianism as we're seeing it now is an expression of metamodernism in the following way. Like, you'll often hear the left-wing identitarian groups say, "Don't erase me," or "We want representation." Like, we want to see people who look like us in Hollywood, you know, or "Don't erase me," like, "Don't use language that doesn't give room for my identity in your version of reality." And to me, that's a metamodern motivation. They're saying, like, my interiority, like, they're not even worrying about, like, material concerns.
See
my identity. Like, there's a me in here, and the me in here is not getting recognized with the way you're speaking and the laws that you're passing and things like that. And then he's also the right-wing identitarianism is kind of the same thing, where you've got these, you know, stereotypical, you know, cishet straight white males or whatever, and they're living in a world where they see the, like, dominant conversation in the media and everywhere like that is about everybody else besides them being seen. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying, "See me too." And so there's this almost, like, toxic version of metamodernism where all these different groups want to be seen, and they treat it like a zero-sum game, and that's unfortunate. But I think that's part of metamodernism too, and that's sort of an example too of, like, why I think it's important to preserve this sense of metamodernism conceptually, and not treat it as, like, an ideological program or, like, a political project. Is, like, if you use metamodernism as, like, your rallying flag and, like, "We're metamodernists" and whatever, like, then everything that you talk about connected to metamodernism has to be good. And now you don't have a conceptual lens for making observations about things that are going on in society now that aren't so good, but are still kind of part of the same trend. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was touched on in your response to Sam Ludford's article, which Jonathan Rausen published in the Perspectiva website, which is, it's dense, but I would encourage people to read it, because you go into that. One of his critiques that, you know, people who are writing with metamodernism, it's like, whatever I like is metamodernism.
Yeah,
which is not it's a structure of analysis, potentially, hopefully, yeah, in the future.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Greg. I'll have to think more about the that connection. But I'm wondering, you know, as we're talking about political instantiations of metamodernism, or at least downstream from the emerging metamodern episteme, like, what are some like positive examples or good examples that you see cropping up to kind of balance out the toxic negativity of the identitarianism
gone bonkers? Toxic identitarian.
Yeah.
I think like early on when Alexandria, we say AOC so frequently that I can't even remember what her
actually Ocasio-Cortez.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Like early on when she first came on the scene, and now she's like so busy actually doing the work that she's kind of dropped some of her metamodernness. But early on, I thought she like really went out of her way to show that she was a human, that she was a person, that she was having fun, that you could have fun, that politics didn't have to be this like really rigid, formalized thing. That's one example. Sarah Silverman is not a politician herself, but she does a lot of things where she'll like go and talk to conservative Bible Belt families and get to find, she plays the Ryan role. So she goes in and she discovers ways that they're all humans. But when they ask her her views, she's open about them. She's not like compromising her views. I think that Obama had a lot of that sensibility as best as he was allowed to. I mean, there was such a backlash against him that I think a lot of the people who he could have reached just weren't open to it. But I think he very much kind of had a vibe and personal expression that was like honoring of the personness of all people. And I'd like to see more of that. And I think that if Democrats had more of that, that eventually they'll probably get through to some of the people who have not been voting for them, but would actually benefit from it.
More politicians who have fun and sing and dance. I remember when Obama, he's saying some song, he's like, I forgot what the song was, but he was singing and that was lovely. And, you know, they tried to kill AOC with the video that they unearthed of her in college dancing to some song. And it just, she was like, yeah, I'm a person.
Yeah.
I'm a human being. So yeah, I agree with you. I'd like to see more of that on both sides.
I've always felt Andrew Yang kind of struck that balance well, where there was a lot of ridiculous, you know, he would meme himself and like, you know, the math thing, make America think harder and, you know, math. And you know, the only person who can beat Trump is an Asian man who likes math. And like, I really appreciate the kind of self-deprecation, you know, implicating an identity group, the one I share, so I'm comfortable talking about it, right? But also this, his own sincerity as someone who cares about solving these problems. Like, I felt that balance was really appealing to me. I feel like if people are too much in one direction, like all sincerity and no irony, I kind of almost feel like I don't really trust you, you know, like, like I start feeling a little bit like weirded out. And if people are only ironic and cynical all the time, I start feeling a little bit like, a little burned out of that, you know, like.
So you're.
Yeah, you're so cool. We got it. Kurt Cobain.
Yeah. So your sensibility is what metamodern art is trying to appeal to. So like the metamodern art is not embarrassed that it has something important and earnest to say, but it just, but yet it's aware of the ironic dimensions and it's aware that it's a self, that it is art, or, you know, it is whatever it is, and that it's not just this sort of like accepted universalized thing. And so it just kind of always plays with both sides of that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because I was thinking about people have been arguing about Jordan Peterson. I mean, they've been arguing about him for a long time, but I think for me, what doesn't appeal to me about him, like aesthetically or in terms of his ethos, is that he kind of seems like overly serious for me. Like I almost want to tell him to like relax, like, you know, like have some, like there's such an intensity and seriousness all the time. And I don't really see the kind of, you know, like that postmodern, healthy, self-deprecating, you know, kind of ironic playfulness or lightness. And that starts feeling to me like really heavy, you know, all mm-hmm. the time, right? And I right. actually, I think that if he integrated, or if anyone integrates the postmodern side, it actually enhances the sincerity.
Yes. And I can't pick any names off the top of my head, but I've noted, I think there are Republican politicians, you know, who have shown the capacity to do that. Like they go on Saturday Night Live and they're just genuinely having fun. Like, oh, like even then, this is a little bit old, but like Rudy Giuliani was in a famous Saturday Night Live skit where he was the cab driver, and then he had like a customer, and I think this is when he was mayor of New York back then. And so like the cab driver character played by Rudy Giuliani, as they were driving around seeing all these crappy things, would go like, fucking Giuliani, you know, and he was able to do that. I hate Giuliani, but I love that about him, you know. This is totally out of left field. It's kind of disconnected, but somebody that just emerged into my mind, Howard Stern, I think has gone through a metamodern evolution. So like there was a time when Howard Stern was just like the paragon of postmodern mm-hmm. cutting irony, you know, pulling the rug out from under people's sense of meaning. But the new Howard Stern who's emerged in like the last 10 years, like cries on camera and is, you know, warm and receptive to his interview subjects, sharing vulnerability. And, you know, he's really insightful. But he's still also that goofy, you know, irreverent Howard Stern at the same time. And so it works. Like the metamodern mind doesn't want to just see like a Mr. Rogers simple kind of sincerity. But we love seeing like Howard Stern open up and show his soft side.
Yeah. So in some sense, it's sort of just, he just got wiser. I mean, that's just something that you say about someone in their lifetime, that they got older and they softened up. Whereas when they were young, they were guarded and they were cynical, you know?
True.
Very interesting. I just had one more question, which was, do you think, Greg, as in terms of a kind of prediction, or maybe to a degree, this has largely already happened and I haven't noticed it explicitly, but in terms of metamodern, you know, memes, styles, right, whether it's in politics or in art, given the age we're in, do you think that people who, like, let's say politicians who present in a very metamodern way, like mm-hmm. like AOC's old stunts, do you think that will have a competitive advantage versus purely postmodern and modern styles, such that we will end up selecting for metamodern content more and more and more?
Yeah, I think we'll see how it plays out. I can't say that so far, like we're overwhelmingly seeing that happening already, but like, I think it probably will. And I guess the reason why I think it will is because you already see that in marketing and advertising and corporate, and like, on Twitter, like so many corporate brands play this extremely metamodern game of playfully, like they get in these playful fights with other brands, or there's like the Steak'em does this thing where they'll like, the Steak'em brand Twitter will say like incredibly meaningful philosophical thing, nuggets, but then tie it into an extremely self-promotional, you know, pro Steak'em thing, and then wrap all of that in awareness of the ridiculousness and profundity of all of that. So I think that this sort of metamodern sensibility is already doing really well in a lot of kind of like commercial play spaces. And it would be neat if it happens with politics too, I guess. Although there's probably a downside and a dark side.
Yeah, well, you know, you could say that, okay, Steak'em, you're being very crafty, but in the end, it's still a profit motive motivating mm-hmm. you, isn't it? So, you know, is your modern version of earnest pastiche and irony, is that, you know, is that ultimately, is what you're trying to do there, to spell the downfall of, you know, the toxic elements of capitalism? Or are you just in the end reifying those basic patterns with a, you know, a wink tempered by a hug, you know, like what are you doing there?
But that's a good phrase, a wink tempered by a hug. I like that. I'll probably end up using that.
Cool. Yeah, but maybe that's for the sequel to this conversation.
You can sum that dilemma up by saying, like, is it this ultimately cynical thing that's weaponizing the metamodern humanistic sensibility? Or the other view is like, well, we live in this commercialized corporate world. It's gonna happen. So I'd rather that the people who are purveying the corporate commercial stuff are fun and have a human side and recognize the importance of my human side.
Well, with that, Greg, this has been a really fun conversation.
Yeah, definitely for me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on and doing this with us.
My pleasure.